But JJ, I'm raising my hand. That doesn't seem like a problem that a former clerk might appear in front of a judge for whom they have clerked. What's the problem?
Oh, no, that's not a problem. Just wait till we get to the real problem, Katie. Welcome to Lawyers Behaving Badly. I am Jennifer Judge.
And I'm Karen Delaney, and this is take five after you trying to get your microphone settings done right. So I'm glad we're finally here.
We are here, almost 2 minutes into recording. We have made it to our intro. So hi friend. How are you?
This is going great for us today.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we haven't seen each other in like 3 whole days since we were in Houston together at the Texas Minority Counsel Program, which was wonderful to be at to present.
It was so nice. It was the best organized conference that we've been to, and just lovely people all around too.
Well, and it's nice to see the State Bar putting resources into a program like that, and just really, really great. And it was fun to present at. And very, very kind of them to extend the invitation. But I haven't seen you in a couple of days, and I have a couple of items for chit chat for us. We don't have a hot toppy today because we're each doing a judge behaving badly. So we don't have any hot toppies, but at least as we would normally do them. But I do have an agenda. The first of which.
You told me that. I laughed. Yes. I can't wait.
The first of which we have already discussed a little bit via text in a group chat, but 1989, Taylor's version, has been on repeat in my house since I got home on Friday afternoon. And last night, as I was cleaning up after dinner, my husband finally cried mercy. And he was like, could you like please put on some Olivia Rodrigo, Dua Lipa or something? Thoughts and comments?
You know my priors on this. At 1989, I feel like this is somewhat heresy, was not one of my favorites of her albums. Like, I think it's good. I think it's fun, but it was not one of my favorites. I have thoroughly enjoyed listening to it, though. I feel like the production value itself is so much better. Even in the past 10 years, I feel like the sound is just better. The listening experience is better. All that being said, I didn't love the remake of Out of the Woods.
That was my, that was the first note that I had. Yeah. I can't get down with it. I'm sorry. You messed it up. That is an incredible, amazing song. And it's worse. It's worse now.
Yeah. People are so mad about how she changed style. I didn't feel like style is any worse. I enjoyed style still, but Out of the Woods was rough. Loved the vault tracks more than most of the songs on the album, honestly, other than Slut. Like, I like Slut. The name of it made me wish it was something else than what it is. So I feel like that's a me thing.
I was looking for a really poppy banger. Something that was going to go really ham. And this just doesn't. It's kind of a little bit like dreamy and breezy.
Yeah.
And I really didn't want that. And I thought with a title like Slut! Exclamation point, we were going to be getting something a little bit different.
Yes. Yeah. I felt the same way. I love, love, love Now That We Don't Talk, and I love Is It Over Now. I think those are fantastic, and it also has been on repeat. You know that I was driving home from Houston on Friday, so I listened to it several times on my drive home, and then we had house guests for most of the weekend, so I was limited somewhat in my ability to blast it around the house, but I did while I was cooking dinner last night after everyone had left, and same thing. It wasn't my husband. It was my oldest came down and he was like, please, can you listen to Lizzo? So at that point I was like, yeah, that's fine. So.
Yeah. I've listened to Is It Over Now like 1,000 times. It is. And when I'm not listening to it, it's just on a continuous loop in my head because that's how my brain works.
Yeah. Permanent.
So that's exciting. And now we need her to drop Reputation. So that we can both go completely fucking feral.
Yes. And we haven't talked about this on the podcast yet, but last weekend, my sister and I went to go see the Eras Tour movie. And to put my sister on blast, prior to going to the movie, she was swifty curious, I would say. Uh-huh. And, you know, she had seen me kind of fallen down into the swifty rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. And at first was making fun of me, but then as I sent her more and more things, she was on board with going to the movie. And during Don't Blame Me was when she leaned over and she was like, I get it. This is so awesome. Yeah. And now she texts me the day 1989 Taylor's version came out. She texted me and was like, I can't stop listening to her music. And I was like, welcome.
Yeah. Welcome. You'll love it here.
To the party. It's so much more fun this way.
Yeah. You'll love it here. So mm-hmm. we just need to post that. And then, okay. My second agenda item is also Taylor Swift related. We have not publicly commented on the Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce situationship. But, and I don't really have a lot to say about that, except, you know, after these artsy dorks she's dated over the mm-hmm. last like decade, good for you, girl. Get a himbo. Get your toes
curled.
Go get
you a jock. Yes.
Good for you. You deserve a jock, girl. Good for you. Yes. But what killed me this weekend, and I needed this because, you know, there's so much just like terrible, awful, crushing mm-hmm. news in the world lately. Travis Kelce has a publicist named Pia. I don't know her last name. She, over the weekend, I think this had to have happened on Saturday night, maybe, because I started seeing it yesterday on TikTok. Mm-hmm. She had like reposted an Instagram story that somebody had tagged her in. It was her birthday and they were wishing her happy birthday. And it's like a grid of photos of her, except in the center, overlaid over all the photos, is a picture taken at one of the Chiefs games that Taylor Swift attended. And the picture is of Taylor Swift with Pia standing behind her, holding her phone up, looking at her phone and scowling. mm-hmm. And somebody has put the clown face emoji over Taylor's whole face.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, and the caption was, happy birthday to our Roman Empire at Pia, whatever her mm-hmm. tag is, which... For those who don't live on social media constantly like you and I do, the whole Roman Empire thing got started because somebody talked to their husband and he mentioned that he thinks about the Roman Empire at least once a day. And they're like, what do you mean mm-hmm. you think about the Roman Empire once a day? And so all the rest of us had to come up with, like, what is our Roman Empire? This sure doesn't seem like it was meant to be posted publicly.
No, it doesn't.
She has since deleted it. She made her account private. She deleted, I think she had like 5,000 or 6,000 followers, and she has deleted all but like 1,000 followers, has not commented on it publicly. Apparently, the girlfriend of hers that made that original post commented under, you know, I mean, this went wild on social media.
Yeah.
And of course, Taylor Swift fans are going insane because they are insane. They're like, how dare you?
How dare you
put a clown face emoji over Taylor's face? So the friend who originally posted this responded to one of these posts, and her comment was something like, I didn't even realize like the clown face emoji. Like, I just thought it was like a, you know, like a happy birthday clown. And it's like, okay, there's only one clown here.
A happy birthday clown.
Like what,
girl,
the fuck? Like, no, that doesn't even make any sense. A birthday clown? Like, that makes no sense whatsoever. And then Dumois, the gossip blogger, has also been posting Insta stories about this. And I've seen somewhere like some speculation that maybe she knows Pia and is friends with her because she's gone hard mm-hmm. to defend Pia and be like, and she was like, oh, it wasn't Pia. It was like an intern that manages her account. Like, you're telling me this publicist has an intern managing their personal account, like a publicist,
yeah.
like
yeah.
their job is social media. That doesn't make any sense either. Like, just own up to the fact that you were being a bunch of mean girls
mm-hmm.
and you don't like Taylor Swift or, you know, whatever. And let it go, you know? And I cannot imagine that Taylor Swift cares about this woman at all.
Not
you know?
Even for a second. Yes. Like, But girlfriend just became a billionaire. Like, she's got bigger things to worry about.
Does not care, I'm sure. But it does make Travis Kelce's whole operation look pretty rinky-dink.
Yes, it does. Now, you sent me those TikToks, and they were delightful to watch. And just like you said, it was something that was, like, very lighthearted and, like, absolutely no-stakes drama that was fun to watch when there is so much terrible going on right now. So it was a delightful weekend diversion for us.
I agree. Yeah. Wonderful. So good luck to Pia. Let us know if you're still employed in a couple of days.
Yeah. Reach out if you have anything you want to talk about. No, just kidding.
Yeah. Drop us a line.
Yeah.
Yeah. Travis signed an NDA, I'm sure, but did you?
Yeah. Well, good. Well, like you said, we have a dual topic today, which is judges behaving badly. And we've got two, one from me and one from you. And I am happy to go first.
I think you should.
With mine. Okay. Mine is not going to be surprising to, I think, anyone who keeps somewhat abreast of legal news or just news in general, because this has kind of broken the lawyer news barrier into Gen Pop. So people are aware of it generally now. But you may have an inkling of this topic if you have been paying attention to the news. It's one of the most shocking ethical lapses that we've seen by a federal judge in a while. And I even include Clarence and Jenny Thomas in that statement. Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I was going to be like, are we okay? Except for Clarence, maybe. Okay. Well, that's some table setting.
Yes. Let me introduce David Jones. David graduated from the University of Houston Law School and received an LLM from Duke, and then joined a bankruptcy boutique in Houston called Kirkendall and Isger. And Marvin Isger was Jones' mentor and champion and lawyer he learned under. So he and Marvin Isger are extremely close. Jones was appointed in 2011 to the Southern District of Texas Bankruptcy Court. And for those who don't know, the Southern District of Texas includes Houston, so one of the largest cities in the country. Not only was Jones appointed, but when he was confirmed, he joined his mentor, Isger, who was already a bankruptcy judge in the Southern District of Texas.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
Is Isger still on the bench?
He is still on the bench.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, keep going. That's interesting.
In perhaps a harbinger of what's to come, I read a bunch of interviews and stories about Jones. And in one in 2020, Jones told the reporter that he accepted the appointment to the Southern District of Texas without telling his then wife, now ex-wife, basically was like, yeah, I'll be a federal judge, and then went through the appointment process without actually ever telling his wife. Judge Jones quickly made a name for himself in the Southern District, and he wanted his court to be a place where large companies wanted to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings. And for those who are unfamiliar with all the different chapters, Chapter 11 proceedings are bankruptcy cases where the company is not liquidating. Basically, they will stay in business, but they're reorganizing on account of their debts and reorganizing their debts. I'm going to send you a screenshot of an article about Judge Jones, and you tell me your thoughts about this.
Oh, okay. It's from Reuters, and it says, U.S. bankruptcy judge David Jones liked to joke that his case manager will answer the phone any time of day or night. The judge says he knows this because he tests him with 3 a.m. phone calls just to see if he picks up. And he always does, Jones likes to say. That's gross. Okay,
so,
cool.
Yeah, so there's a little tidbit of what we need to know about David Jones as we go through our story about him.
I guarantee you this court clerk is not making enough money to be getting
whatever they're being paid. Yes.
Middle of the night phone calls from this guy. Okay.
Eventually, Judge Jones becomes chief judge of the Southern District of Texas Bankruptcy Courts. He and Judge Isger had the second largest docket of complex Chapter 11 cases in the country, and he oversaw bankruptcies of companies like Neiman Marcus, JCPenney, and Chesapeake Energy. So he was kind of known as one of the go-to places to go file your bankruptcy if you were looking at a Chapter 11 corporate bankruptcy. And there is one more bankruptcy that we should talk about. And one of the most notable recent cases involves a company called Corizon. And are you familiar at all with Corizon Health, KP?
Maybe a little bit because of this story. I believe they are responsible for healthcare in prisons, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they have been at the wrong end of, I think, class actions from prisoners or maybe just individual lawsuits. I don't remember. But basically people who are like, you committed medical malpractice by mistreating me or denying me medical treatment that I needed.
Yeah,
am I right?
Yep, that's exactly right. They are a for-profit medical care company that contracts with prisons to provide quote-unquote health care to prisoners. And I cannot do this topic justice. If you're interested in the horrible conditions in which these companies purport to provide health care to privileges or prisoners, John Oliver very recently did his long story on a Last Week Tonight from a few weeks ago, and his main topic was Corizon and the other large healthcare companies providing these services to prisoners. And basically, the lack of care, lack of regard for humanity, deplorable conditions that they are putting these people in, and what they've resulted from, it basically will shock your conscience of any decent person. Mm-hmm. So I can't, like I said, I can't do it justice, but keep this in mind. And I don't know if people are going to be like pounding the dashboard as they listen to this, but just because someone is in prison doesn't mean they completely lack humanity and they don't deserve a standard of care of healthcare. So just going to set that right there on the table for this.
Well, let's just go further and say that, any for-profit entity should not be operating prisons at large.
Yes.
Or delivering mm-hmm. healthcare. Like, shareholder value shouldn't be determining what happens in prisons or with medical related healthcare. So,
exactly.
It's awful. It's awful.
Corizon Health was the largest company providing this service, and they were formed through a merger in 2011. And then from then to their ultimate bankruptcy, they were dogged by many, many allegations of substandard care, unpaid vendor bills, employment claims, and numerous lawsuits. And just as evidence of that, in 2019, Corizon lost a $350 million contract with Arizona prisons and with the New York City jails. They were, up until that point, the healthcare provider for those places.
I feel like if you lose your contract with New York City jails and Arizona state prisons,
mm-hmm.
that is definitely an indictment of
the
extremely low quality of your already extremely low quality services.
Rikers was like, whoa, 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 this is pretty poor service. A New York State panel specifically found Corizon's treatment, quote, so incompetent and inadequate as to shock the conscience.
Mm-hmm.
In 2021, Corizon's bought by an investor group. And in April 2022, Corizon is sued by a large hospital claiming they owed it at least $12 million in unpaid healthcare services provided to prisoners. The company was also facing about 500 lawsuits from prisoners, just like you referenced, claiming medical malpractice that led to either being permanently injured or death. Later that month in 2022, Corizon changed the state from which it was incorporated from Delaware to Texas. And any guess where this is going?
Well, I mean, I know they filed bankruptcy in his court. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So they engaged in what's now called like the Texas two-step. Basically, they split themselves into two companies, YesCare, which is a terrible name, which held Corizon's revenue and all of its positive contracts and contracts that drove revenue.
And then they dumped all the liabilities into another entity.
Yep. The old Corizon was rebranded as Tehum and had all of Corizon's debts and liabilities, including all of the lawsuits alleging medical mistreatment.
Yeah. And then you put that through bankruptcy.
Yep.
And people who settled with you or have a judgment against you now hold like pennies on the dollar.
Yep. They've immediately filed bankruptcy in the Southern District of Texas. Tehum does. And this was famously first used by, or recently used by Johnson & Johnson, trying to evade judgments in cases where its baby powder was alleged to have caused cancer. That was shot down by appellate court. So we're kind of see if the Texas two-step is alive and well. But this is relatively recent. But all those lawsuits Corizon was facing were shoved into the Tehum entity. So when it filed for bankruptcy, they were all subject to the automatic stay and basically couldn't go forward. And in fact, one of the Tehum directors has publicly said that the Texas two-step was being used to force the plaintiffs into accepting lower settlements.
Sure.
Now, here's where we get to Judge Jones. He was appointed as the mediator and to oversee all settlement talks between Tehum and its creditors.
Hey, and question, who was Tehum represented by?
Oh, don't jump the gun. We'll get there. Don't worry. So under the plans approved by Judge Jones, all those cases against Corizon for medical malpractice would be settled for a maximum of $5,000 each. And these were like death cases and things like that. Awful. So you said, why are we talking about this bankruptcy story when we're talking about a judge behaving badly? What we haven't discussed is the lawyer who was representing YesCare, the entity with all the assets.
Okay, YesCare. Yeah, okay.
That was spun off of Corizon in the Texas two-step maneuver. And we will call her Linda Lawyer. And Linda is a former clerk of David Jones. She clerked for him for 6 years before later joining Jackson Walker's bankruptcy practice. And
raising my hand. That doesn't seem like a problem that a former clerk might appear in front of a judge for whom they have clerked. What's the problem?
Oh, no, that's not a problem. Just wait till we get to the real problem, Katie. She abruptly left Jackson Walker in 2021 and spun up her own solo practice. And that was kind of weird that she just abruptly left. So Linda represented YesCare in front of Judge Jones. And all while that was happening, Linda and Judge Jones were living together and were romantically involved and owned a home together. Do we see any problems with this?
Yeah, that's a huge fucking problem. And yeah. I am probably stealing some of your thunder now, but what I cannot get over with this story is that we learned that they have lived together for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I just searched because I'm not familiar with the bankruptcy court in the Southern District of Texas. So I just Googled and there are four other judges on this court. So that's a court before before this plays out, that would have been five judges. So this went on for years.
Mm-hmm.
You're telling me nobody else knew that he was shacking up with his former clerk who is now at Jackson Walker leading these bankruptcy cases or on these bankruptcy cases appearing in his court?
When one of them was an extremely close mentor and friend.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Nobody knew about this?
Well, somebody knew about this because that's how we're going to get to how it all blew up.
I love the intrigue here.
Mm-hmm. In what is a very unlikely sentence for anyone who is familiar with pro se litigation to say, a complaint filed by a pro se plaintiff against Judge Jones is the one that blew the lid off this entire scheme with Judge Jones. In October of this year, the pro se plaintiff filed a lawsuit against the judge, alleging that the judge violated his civil rights. And in the lawsuit, the plaintiff said, you know, I had filed a lawsuit against a company that was in bankruptcy at the time in 2021. I filed the lawsuit in state court, but because of the bankruptcy, it became an adversary proceeding in the bankruptcy that was currently pending in Judge Jones' court. The company he sued was represented by Linda Lawyer in the bankruptcy in Judge Jones' court. And during that adversary proceeding, our pro se plaintiff received an anonymous letter in the mail, which explained that Judge Jones and Linda were romantically involved in dating. And everyone in Houston, you know, basically knew of the scheme, but didn't talk about it. And it also alleged that the relationship was widely known because clients knew they could hire Jackson Walker and Linda specifically to represent them for preferential treatment in Judge Jones' court in bankruptcy. In that adversary proceeding, the pro se plaintiff filed a motion to recuse Judge Jones based on that anonymous letter. But since he didn't have any evidence beyond the letter, the motion to recuse was denied. Guess which judge heard that motion to recuse?
Oh, it had to have been Isger, right?
His mentor? Judge Isger. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Then something interesting happened after that motion to recuse was denied. Linda Lawyer abruptly left Jackson Walker and spun up her own solo practice.
So that was in 2021 then.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And Judge Jones issued an order against the pro se plaintiff that said any further litigation, federal or state court, brought by the pro se plaintiff regarding this case or this company ever, basically, should be removed immediately to this court. If such litigation is initiated and the current pattern of behavior continues, the court will revisit the issue of compensatory and coercive sanctions necessary. Like, the guy had not done anything other than file a motion to recuse, and he gets this massively over-the-top order from Judge Jones, and go ahead.
Well, that's also not how jurisdiction works, where you're I get to have all of these cases forever.
Especially a bankruptcy court.
Yeah.
You don't get to say if he files a lawsuit in Houston, you know, Texas State Court in Houston over a tort, that doesn't get to go straight to the bankruptcy court. And Right. Even the pro se plaintiff pointed that out.
Yeah, it's crazy. But that also tells you, like, the judge knew he was onto something.
Mm-hmm.
And so thought he could, apparently thought he could intimidate him into silence.
Yeah, basically railroad him into silence with this order. The pro se plaintiff kind of bides his time until October 2023 when he has receipts in his lawsuit that he files against Judge Jones. Because despite the judge's denials in 2021 that he was in a relationship with Linda Lawyer, our plaintiff went through the public housing records and found that Judge Jones and Linda had lived together since at least 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did they live together, they jointly owned a $1 million house since 2017. So that means they were romantically involved way before that, because you are not buying a home with someone the minute you start dating. Like, they had been together at least for a little while prior to that to jointly own a home together.
My mind is just also reeling at Jackson Walker, just, yes, I guess, being cool with this whole thing. Because the thing is that the bankruptcy bar is not that big.
No.
It's really not. And especially if you're representing large companies and you're mostly doing corporate reorganizations or dissolutions, and you're not the bankruptcy lawyer who represents, you know, Joe Blow, who has too much credit card debt or whatever. That bar is pretty small. And it's astonishing to wonder what was going on at Jackson Walker those days.
Well, they told, obviously we'll get to it, but this blows up in traditional media as well. And Jackson Walker told the Wall Street Journal that they learned of the relationship as a result of the pro se's motion to recuse in 2021. Huh. And they say they investigated and told Linda that she could not work or bill on any case assigned to Judge Jones. And she basically, that's what led her to leave, since her grift was over at Jackson Walker at that point. Like, what's the point of practicing bankruptcy for her if she can't be in Judge Jones' court when she was known as the go-to at that point?
Allegedly, she's known as the go-to.
So that's Jackson Walker's side of the story.
Huh. But, okay. I mean, I don't have any information one way or another, but I've practiced in an office of a regional law firm.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, at least in my office, everybody knew who everybody else was dating and married to. And we certainly met everybody's spouses and partners. And okay, if that's the story. Yeah. All right.
So 3 days after the pro se plaintiff files his lawsuit, Business Insider breaks the story into the mainstream media.
Yes.
And while Judge Jones doesn't respond to Insider's request for comment, he did confirm to the Wall Street Journal that he had been and was romantically involved with Linda Lawyer. And he parses the situation with the care that only a lawyer looking for a loophole could do, because he says that he didn't believe he had a duty to disclose his relationship because he, quote, wasn't married and, quote, didn't benefit economically from Linda's work. So all
which
free
is
and clear.
Such horseshit, because it's like, you didn't benefit economically from the work of the person who resides in your household and is like your co-deed holder.
Yes.
You didn't benefit from that at all. Not to mention, like, It also doesn't matter if you actually benefited from it or not, but the appearance that you might have benefited from it, or that she did, and that litigants were treated more favorably or less favorably based on their relationship to her and her relationship to him. That like simply that appearance is the problem.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I was thinking about was you know, in a much lower stakes context, you don't even want supervisors overseeing someone that they are dating because of the potential conflict of interest or the appearance of a potential conflict of interest, even if they think, you know, they can handle it on the up and up. And so if you don't want that in a traditional business context, maybe we should hold federal judges to a higher standard than that. But
well,
also
certainly if any of the opposing counsel had known about it, you would think
yes,
that they would have filed a motion for the judge to recuse himself unless they are also a part of the local bar and practicing in front of him frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And they think to themselves, this is just how it's going to be because I'm not going to be the one to say anything because he's going to like
put my client
at risk.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
put my client at risk.
Yeah. I'm not going to put my client at risk by mentioning this. But you have to think that like there are probably a lot of opposing counsel out there that had they known, they would have wanted him off the case.
Well, he's also just wrong too, because the commentary to the Code of Conduct for United States judges provides that recusal considerations applicable to a judge's spouse should also be considered with respect to a person other than a spouse with whom the judge maintains both a household and intimate relationship.
Obviously.
Clearly people have thought about this before.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course they have, because lawyers are terrible people.
Yes.
and do stupid horny things. Like,
yes, exactly.
You know?
Judge Jones also told the Wall Street Journal that he owns the home and paid the utilities all on his own, and Belinda just lived there. But again, they're both listed on the deed. Like,
you pay the utilities. What is that? Mm-hmm. Like $1,000 a month or something? Like,
yeah.
Okay. Do you really want to talk about your bill splitting practices with Linda Lawyer?
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about how like she picks up the Amazon and the HEB tab and the DoorDash tab,
exactly,
and you get utilities? Like, that doesn't make any fucking sense.
He said his agreement with Linda was that she would never, quote, appear in his courtroom, even though she had billed for and represented parties that were in his courtroom, but she wasn't physically there. So that was what counts.
She just like her image appears in a crystal ball and then
exactly
disappears in a flash of smoke.
The Wall Street Journal continued the reporting done by Insider and the pro se plaintiff. They found also a survivorship agreement tied to the home that listed both Jones and Linda on the deed. And basically that said that if they owned the property jointly and one died, the other inherited the property in full, which again is not something you enter into if you just started seeing someone in 2017. Either. Like, these people were clearly in a long-term relationship.
Yeah, and it's not like a roommate thing either, you know?
No, exactly.
I mean, that's the thing that kills me about the utilities comment, is he's trying to make it sound like they're roommates.
Mm-hmm.
And they so obviously are not. And it's also just a fascinating dynamic, because these excuses are just so weak.
Yes.
And obviously flimsy. If you give these excuses to the media and national media, not just like niche legal media, like
Law 360. This is like Wall Street Journal. Yeah.
Yeah. If these are the sort of flimsy excuses that you are giving to the national media, instead of resigning outright immediately, that tells me that you have no expectation that you are actually going to be held accountable for this kind of conduct, which also tells me a lot about the environment that you have been working in during the course of this relationship.
100% my thoughts as well. Like, he for sure thought he was going to just ride this out and it wasn't going to be that big a deal because he'd done it so far.
Like, well, that ended quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the steam picked up after all of this happened. There were 16 cases where Linda billed for work that was in Judge Jones' courtroom for Chapter 11 bankruptcies. And just a note, in all 16 of those cases, Kirkland & Ellis was the national counsel representing the client, and Jackson Walker was the local counsel. So it was clearly a known setup.
But this is before she leaves Jackson Walker?
This was before she leaves Jackson Walker.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. As all this news comes out, the Fifth Circuit, which oversees the district judges reporting to it for matters like this, initiates an ethical investigation into Judge Jones. And the chief judge of the Fifth Circuit, Priscilla Richmond, filed an ethical complaint against Jones. And in that, they noted they had found probable cause to believe that Judge Jones had committed misconduct.
By the way, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this all happened over like a week. I mean, I want to say this story dropped on like a Friday night. Mm-hmm. And by like Tuesday, I think we had this ethical complaint, and it mm-hmm. dropped like a bomb in yes. the mm-hmm. nerdy legal circles that we follow. You don't see the Fifth Circuit filing an ethics complaint against one of the district court judges. Like, it's crazy.
It was crazy. And it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't like an, oh, this is an ethical complaint and it's an order and it's a paragraph. This was like 4 or 5 pages mm-hmm. of facts and allegations that it said it had found probable cause to initiate an investigation. About a day later, the Judge Jones, quote unquote, voluntarily removed himself, agreed to be removed from his cases pending the outcome of that investigation. On that same day, the Office of the U.S. Trustee intervened in the Corizon case, filing multiple objections to the proposed settlement plan that had been approved by Jones.
Well, and obviously,
Yeah, exactly. Filed concerns about Jones' role in the case. And at this point, the ending is starting to become inevitable because on October 14th, Judge Jones resigns after that official misconduct investigation begins. His resignation is effected November 15th, which is very nice to be able to resign for misconduct and get yourself still a month of employment after that happens. And as a result of his resignation, the Fifth Circuit investigation ends and is moot because they don't continue those.
Okay, that was going to be my next mm-hmm. question, because I can think of a number of reasons that he resigned, like this looking really bad and reflecting very poorly on the integrity of the bankruptcy court in the Southern District, not wanting to put his roommate through mm-hmm. this sort of public scrutiny, and the fact that these stories were likely to snowball and gain more scrutiny. But with his resignation, it made me think of the investigation into mm-hmm. Judge Kaczynski at the Ninth Circuit. Mm-hmm. And there were all sorts of allegations of misconduct and sexual harassment related to him, all of which came to a grinding halt because he resigned from the Ninth Circuit. And apparently the way that the federal courts handle these investigations is if you resign, like, they just don't bother completing the investigation, which, side note, this is a completely separate discussion, from my perspective, is completely inadequate.
It's insane. Like,
it's completely insane. Like, you wouldn't, if somebody quit, if an alleged harasser left their job at a company, I don't think you would just put pencils down on an investigation. Like, you would want to understand what happened, who knew,
mm-hmm.
and are there any other remedial actions you need to take beyond simply removing the alleged harasser from the workplace? I mean, there might be other sorts of discipline that is appropriate, or restructuring, whatever it is that's appropriate, if you bother to learn all the facts. And so one of the thoughts that had occurred to me here was, gosh, you know, we have so many questions about these other judges, these four other judges, including his mentor, and how nobody managed to say anything for years and years. And I guess what? That's just not going to go anywhere now?
Yep, because basically under the rules that govern these, as soon as the remedy against the judge would be moot, the investigation ends. So just like you
said.
That's
insane.
It's insane because it's my exact same perspective as yours. Like, you would still in a company conduct the investigation because you'd want to know root causes. You'd want to know what environment led to it. You'd want to know who knew, anyone else implicated. I mean, there are a lot of things that you can learn from an investigation, and to basically end it at that point is just perpetuating the entire problem. So,
right. Because you're essentially like, at least with this, we can surmise that other people who had a responsibility to report this conduct knew about it. Somebody mm-hmm. knew. I mean, mm-hmm. we know somebody knew because
they send in anonymous letters.
They sent an anonymous letter to this one guy, and you have to wonder, was this just the one guy who got lucky and got a anonymous letter? Or has the person, the letter writer, sent out dozens of these letters, mm-hmm. and this is just the first one that bit? This is just the first recipient that yeah. bit. So we can surmise that other people who had a duty to report or do something about this knew, and they didn't. And it is completely, completely unhinged to be like, well, all right, that's over now. Carry on.
Yeah. And it's funny you mentioned Kaczynski, because I thought to myself, you know, what was it? Not last week, but maybe a few weeks ago, like, Kaczynski was arguing appellate arguments on behalf of Donald Trump, but like, he's out there arguing and you can resign, the investigation goes nowhere, and then you just spin up your own practice and you're no worse for wear because you were a prior federal judge now and people may hire you for that. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's going to be, there is no, other than losing your lifetime tenure job, what are the repercussions that are going to follow when you resign like this?
I'm sure it sucks to have to go be a practicing trial attorney mm-hmm. or appellate attorney, whatever Kaczynski is doing, versus being a federal judge with clerks and staff and having all the mm-hmm. trappings that come with the influence of being a federal appellate judge. But yeah, like, he'll be fine. He's fine.
Yeah,
he's working. Fine. He's gainfully employed. And there are probably plenty of people out there who we know there are plenty of people out there who continue to defend Judge Kaczynski because we watched yeah. it in real time play out on yes. Twitter with former clerks coming out of the woodwork to discredit their other co-clerks mm-hmm. or to suggest that because they had never witnessed anything untoward, somehow that meant that
other people were lying. Yeah.
yeah, that these other people weren't mm-hmm. credible and that never could have happened. And there are going to be plenty of people who don't pay as close attention to the news as maybe you and I do, and who also think, well, he resigned. There was never any lawsuit against him. There were never any findings against him. This mm-hmm. is just he said, she said, and he got ran out of town because of a misunderstanding.
Yeah, it's all cancel culture, basically, run amok at this point.
Yeah.
So that is the story of Judge Jones. It's still percolating. I think there's going to be more to see, I'm sure. Now that the national media is involved, I'll be curious to see if there's more people digging things up about this, or if it just dies a quiet death because he resigned. One final note that I think, I don't know if it was from you or someone else. I'm texting you this now. It was the ending to one of the stories about his resignation. And this made me laugh out loud. Because it was how they ended the story about his resignation and how his cases are being reassigned among the judges of the Southern District of Texas.
Okay. Chief U.S. District Judge Randy Crane of the Southern District of Texas said the court is prepared to consider any requests from parties involved in bankruptcies Jones oversaw to review his decisions. But he said he doesn't believe there will be many requests and that for the most part, people are content with how their cases were handled. How do you know? How do you know this?
How do you know? Like, and clearly they're not, because the pro se plaintiff is the one that kicked this entire thing off and he wasn't happy with how his case was handled.
But also that is really frustrating because it just so blithely ignores the power dynamics when you yes. have life tenured federal judges, some of whom, like I said, we can surmise knew about this and did nothing. Mm-hmm. And you have practitioners who are in their courts on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And who have That's to keep them content so that you don't put your client at a disadvantage. Like, you can't stick your neck out for that, or else you put your client at risk. So it completely ignores that reality of practicing in front of judges.
I think that's crazy.
Mm-hmm. So on that happy note, that is Judge Jones. I think the lessons are pretty straightforward on this one. don't do that.
Write that down.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. We recorded that previous segment on Monday. And of course, on Tuesday night, Reuters published an article with some more information about this. And you and I said we were hoping that there would be more that came of this and that people would mm-hmm. dig instead of just letting the Fifth Circuit drop it because Judge Jones resigned and brought that whole process to a halt. And so what we have decided to do is give a little update on what Reuters had to say, and then we will do my story about our other judge, which is very funny, by the way.
So funny. I cannot wait. It's so funny.
So funny. We will do that next week. And then we'll pick up with another story about a lawyer behaving badly after that. So do you want to share with the group what Reuters had to say last night that prompted this update?
Yes. And it's just like you said, it's just like we said, people are digging into things now, and Reuters went and dug into all of Jackson Walker, that's the firm where Linda Lawyer worked, all of their filings in Judge Jones' court on behalf of the debtors in bankruptcy. And for those of you who are unaware, when you represent a debtor in a bankruptcy action, you have to certify that there are no potential conflicts of interest between the debtor, its lawyers, the creditors, and, quote, parties of interest. And it doesn't specifically reference judges as a potential conflict of interest or parties in interest, but it's apparently routine for larger law firms to certify affirmatively that they searched for connections to the judges in bankruptcy court and certified that the potential conflicts of interest do not exist. Amazingly, in all of those cases where Linda Lawyer was on the case and where Jackson Walker was in Judge Jones' court, none of those cases have a certification that a potential conflict of interest may exist.
Well, there were three. There were three, right? So there were 30 cases, and only three of them, apparently, did Jackson Walker file the disclosures that are required by the federal bankruptcy rules.
Correct. And this is both before and after it would have known about Linda Lawyer's relationship with Judge Jones as a result of the pro se's lawsuit that we were talking about.
Yeah, if you take at face value their explanation, yeah. Which I frankly think is not credible at all if you've ever worked in a law firm. I mean, everybody is in everybody else's business.
Yeah, I mean, it's just unheard of for someone to have a spouse, but a live-in partner that they own a home with, and you to be like, I don't know their identity. I don't know who they are. Who is this person? They've never talked about use their partner's name that they've lived with since 2017. So yeah, it's strange credulity to think that that's even possible at this point.
No, I don't believe that for a second. Like, I could buy that maybe there's a managing partner in the Houston office who didn't know or something, because I mean, I've worked with people before who aren't up on the office gossip.
Yes.
Which, you know, gossip is knowledge and power. So reconsider that, but no, it's just not credible. And then what makes it even less credible in my eyes is that according to this Reuters article, when they quote unquote discovered that she was romantically entangled with the judge that they were appearing in front of, that's when she left the law firm. And you would think, oh, that's the end of that relationship. No, apparently she becomes a contractor for the law firm like the next day. So it's like, we don't have a problem with you continuing to do work for us. We're just not going to keep you on our payroll as an employee, which doesn't seem to me like it fixes the problem at all, but go off, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly it. She becomes a contract lawyer for the firm, and then she has a key role in this company's wind down that's overseen by Judge Jones. And not only is she a contractor for the law firm, she's being paid over $100,000 a month for that work. So
yeah,
I want to emphasize
that you are not like that. That's not like you meant to say $100,000 a year.
No,
her rate was supposed to be $700 an hour, and she was supposed to be getting $100,000 per month for a year, after which time it would drop down to only $50,000 per month.
Yeah.
And you still have this judge being like, oh, don't worry about it. Like, I didn't economically benefit from that.
Yes. It's
blows my mind. Blows my mind.
I think there's still a lot more to come from this investigation. Obviously, the U.S. Trustee's Office is interested and involved, and they're going to start looking at a lot of these cases. it's very possible that Jackson Walker may have to disgorge all the fees that they were awarded as a result of these bankruptcy cases, which, you know, by some reports could be up to $27 million, which Jackson Walker is a big firm that wouldn't like crash the firm or anything, but it would obviously have an effect on a bottom line, and it certainly hurts your reputation in the market of hiring lawyers and hiring partners and attracting business. So that's something to think about. Yeah.
I can imagine some equity partners who are outside the restructuring practice being extremely pissed about this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, because now not only is it an ethical concern, but also now it's directly hitting their bottom line. So that's how you get equity partners pretty pissed off. Obviously, there are potential, you know, if you take it very, very far, there's potential criminal actions that the U.S. trustee could refer this to the U.S. attorney if they wanted to. Who knows if it goes that far? It's certainly possible. And then, you know, we'll TBD on whether there's ethical actions as a result of this with the Texas bar. It's possible. I wouldn't hold my breath.
I mean, yeah, I think based on everything we've seen on this podcast, there's good reason for us to not hold our breath related to any state bar holding people accountable. But I mean, I think there has to be in this case, because this directly impacts the integrity of the judiciary and the perceived integrity of the judiciary. And what actually most got me about this article is that you had had me read this quote by the chief U.S. district judge, Randy Crane, who basically was like, oh, NBD, like, you know, we don't think there are going to be many requests to review these decisions. And for the most part, like, people are content with how their cases are handled. And then what Reuters says is that as a result of Judge Jones resigning, 3,200 cases had to be reassigned. Mm-hmm. And that's just active cases, I presume.
Yeah, and this that's was just conduct, active cases.
Yes, this was conduct that went on for a number of years. I mean, we don't even know when the relationship started. We just know when they bought a house together. So this was conduct that went on for a number of years, and active cases only reassigned 3,200. And so for the chief judge to suggest that people, for the most part, are content with how their cases were handled, as we pointed out, there's no way for you to know that. There's absolutely no way for you to know that. Mm-hmm. It ignores the dynamics between federal judges and the lawyers that appear between them. It also ignores that there are probably a large portion of these litigants that have no idea that this has happened because they're not reading the news. They don't know about this stuff, and nobody has notified them to let them know. And when I saw that 3,200 number from Reuters, I immediately thought of Judge Crane's comments. And I thought, wow, I have some real questions about the integrity of the Southern District of Texas at this point, if that's how the chief judge is approaching this and essentially saying, hey, there's nothing to see here, when there so obviously is. That is so appalling to me.
And one thing I don't think I mentioned in the main segment was he was, by numbers, the busiest bankruptcy court judge in the country. Like, he had the largest docket in the country. That is, even just on a numbers scale alone, a lot of cases that could be implicated and a lot of people that could have second thoughts about what happened in their lawsuit, because these were major companies that he was helping restructure in his bankruptcy court that affected real people. So you cannot just say, oh, I'm sure people are happy with the way things turned out, because you have no idea. You don't know.
Yeah. And also the fact that a layperson has feelings one way or another about it doesn't necessarily mean that it's fine. You know, I mean, there are all sorts of things that people who are not lawyers and who are not judges don't understand about how, what should and should not happen. And so their opinion about whether it's fine is kind of irrelevant sometimes, you know? So that actually, I felt a physical revulsion when I saw that number and thought about Judge Crane's comments. That is just, wow, it's a sad day for the Southern District.
I think there's still going to be more coming out as more and more journalists dig into this. So I'm certain we'll have more updates. Like we said, the Fifth Circuit's investigation may be over, but clearly journalists are digging into this and looking into this because it's a real story. And there are things here that the public should know about. So stay tuned. We'll have, I'm certain, more updates as they come out. Maybe not by this episode coming up tomorrow. This may be our last update for this one.
We're not recording again because I do have to edit this. So, and I've got other work to do. But yes, stay tuned for that. I'm very interested to see what happens and have a pretty dim view of what's going on in the Southern District right now. And then next week, you are going to get our next judge behaving badly, which this was kind of a serious episode about serious stuff. This judge also did serious stuff, but it is really, really funny. So I am very excited about that.
I told my husband about that episode basically as soon as we finished filming or recording it. I was like, get a load of this. We laughed so hard. So I can't wait. Like,
if Karen and I were judges, this is like,
yes,
we'd know better. But you know, if you made a comment during that episode that this is like, if you and I were hanging out in a meeting or something, this is what you get out of it. You're not wrong. So, all right, great. Have a great week, everybody. As always, you can leave us a review. We are on social media at Bad Lawyer Pod, and then you can also email us tips, comments, etc. at badlawyerpod@gmail.com. We'll talk to y'all next week.
Thanks, guys.